Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. I've got my co-host Rob Greenlee with me this morning. Merry Christmas, everyone, and happy Hanukkah or happy holidays, depending on which persuasion you like. But good morning, Rob. How are you?
Doing terrific, Todd. It's great to be here again. So close to Christmas and the new year, so 2014 right around the corner, and CES and the New Media Expo and all those things are coming up on our annual journey through the new media world. So you're going to be busy.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my team members that I go to a CES, and I said, I feel like I'm behind, but I keep looking at my list of stuff to do, and I'm good. And, you know, it's one of those weird deals where, you know, maybe you've gotten to the point where you've done it enough times, it's kind of like old hat, but it still makes me nervous. What am I forgetting? But hopefully the weather holds and the FedEx trucks will start rolling with the gear towards Vegas here in a few days. But needless to say, that we can talk about that another time. We've got a great guest today on board. We've got Scott Sigler on. Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Well, as good, as it could be. And I know you're in San Francisco and you're just telling me that you're going to kind of have a light and easy holidays, and you're not looking forward to having to you don't want to be part of the masses fighting the weather this year.
No, I was watching the news this morning and seeing expect lots of cancellations, expect delays, and there's ice and snow everywhere. So all of my travel's done for a while, and I'll just be chilling at home for Christmas. So looking forward to that.
That's cool. So Rob, anything new in the podcast front before we get started with Scott, or anything of note?
Well, there's always stuff kind of bubbling around. There's no question. You know, there is, as probably many heard, there was some stuff bouncing around about the Windows Phone podcast area. And so, you know, I just want to make sure everybody is aware that, everything is fine on that front. So, you know, it's, when the Xbox Music and Xbox video apps came out, that kind of created a little bit of concern because podcast wasn't part of the Xbox Music app. But everything's fine. You know, the podcast area is just the same as it always has been. And so anyway, I just wanted to kind of dispel that. I've been trying to do that on Twitter too, to try and get people to calm down. You know, the world isn't caving on podcasting at Microsoft. So that's about the biggest news. You know, I think that the other thing that's going on is that I'm getting a sense from many new and existing companies that the podcasting business is getting a little bit more serious now. So I don't know, Todd, if you're seeing that. There seems to be more of an effort around trying to do the right thing with podcasting.
It's interesting that you say that. I cannot confirm or deny, but I will say we've had some calls in the past week that have been kind of interesting from a measurement standpoint. So, in other words, coming in and using our stats service. So it's, I think there is a little bit of that going on for sure. But one thing, one thing that we've already started to see is the folks at Apple are taking off. Their podcast division takes off from the 21st to the 27th. So anyone that's starting a new show right now, don't get excited because you're not going to get anything approved until probably the 28th. So enjoy the holiday.
Yeah, and it does kind of make you wonder if they're doing some upgrades to their system or if basically everybody's taking the holiday off. I'm not quite sure which one it is.
They've done this a couple of years in a row, so I think it might be that they're taking the holiday off. But who knows? And if they are upgrading, we'll see what they have for us when they get back. But So, Scott, you know, you've been with this podcasting thing just as long as Rob and I have. You started in the very beginning in 2004.
March 2005 is when I launched my first episode.
So, you've been here from the beginning with us. And what's your general sense, you know, before we get into kind of what you're doing, what's your general sense of this, you know, the state of the space right now?
Well, we don't really have a lot of time to look at the larger picture. We kind of focus on what we are doing and putting out our free fiction serialized audiobooks via all the podcast formats. And for us, it's still going great. We put out an episode a week. We've been doing that every Sunday since 2005. And we run advertising against it. And we've built up enough of an audience now that that's a revenue stream for us. We're making money off podcasting, which I think is about the best anybody can hope for in it. And largely doing what I do, promoting the books, I get to go on other shows. And I've been on Adam Carolla and Joe Rogan and been on Nerdist and watching. Those are three of the really successful podcasts right now. And watching all of those people build kind of a mini media empire based around their podcast, people are doing well with it. And if you've got a show that is compelling and people want to listen to, you're going to get followers and you're going to have an audience to which you can leverage either to sell your own product or sell advertising. I think it's going great guns. And I think you also can see how hard it is for a startup podcaster that's not an existing media star to get a show going, because now the market is full of NPR and ESPN and, you know, podcasts about every show that's on television, et cetera. So yeah, the networks clearly see what's going on and have been putting effort into it for a long time. So I think the overall state of podcasting is great. I think it's harder now for an indie person to get into it. But at the same time, it's still the single best way I can think of, podcasting and YouTube, for someone to develop a personality, develop a brand, and reach a big audience.
You know, I had a call, actually it was more of a email exchange with a guy the other day, and he's got a small network of maybe, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 shows, maybe 12, and they've upgraded their studio to go HD, and they're reformatting all of their show formats to go short format, and they're going to primarily be looking as YouTube as their growth spot. And he was asking me, should I continue with the audio program? Should I continue to publish that? And, you know, I was kind of surprised, because when I went and looked at his YouTube numbers, the YouTube numbers were okay, but not paying really any bills with. And then I looked at his, at least what I would consider to be, you know, the type of level you need to be to really be generating good revenue on YouTube. And then I looked, kind of talked with him a little bit about his podcast numbers. And it was clear to me that I knew where the, you know, where he was still making money. And I found it incredible that he was thinking about dropping the audio portion of his programming. He's the first guy I've seen, at least in a while, that is considered leaving the podcasting space for YouTube. And, I don't know. I've been on YouTube a long time, and I've yet to get a check from YouTube. Of course, you know, I started off as a podcaster too, so it's, you know, my audience and my format is not designed for YouTube. But, you know, do you think, I know you're experimenting, or you're on YouTube and you've got a modicum of success over there as well, but, what's your thoughts on podcasters being on YouTube, and can they make money at it?
I don't know about making money. We haven't made any money off of YouTube from straight up advertising from YouTube, but we are, you know, that, and that's the dance you play over there is, can I get in bumpers for, say we do a lot of advertising for GoDaddy. Can I get GoDaddy bumpers into the beginning of a podcast episode or of a YouTube video and get those exposures to my smaller audience? And will that move the needle? Is that going to bring anybody to our page to look at the different deals that we have available?
Right.
And that works. That works for us, but we're not at a number that's A, big enough for YouTube to send us any money, and B, big enough to get YouTube's attention. I mean, they're probably focused on policing primarily, you know, the Toby Turners and the iJustines and Ryan Higa and those type shows that are just pulling in crazy numbers. And it's hard to find out exactly how much these people are being paid, but it sounds like they're making a pretty good living. That being said, YouTube to me still trends really, really young. And people, you know, the people who are going to succeed in there are probably getting into it now, are in, you know, under 30 or early 30s. And that's something else people have to keep in mind. I think there's all demographics watching YouTube to watch a lot of different things. But the breakout stars are all in a younger demographic. And that's, you have to be sort of there to get the kind of numbers needed to make any money at it. But podcasting, you're still, if you're smart, you're controlling everything yourself, and you, whatever you can go out and get advertising for is what you can get, and you don't have to deal with YouTube. And now YouTube's a giant corporate company, just like every other giant corporate company. And with that comes a lot of rules, and they control what's going on.
And I don't want to steal your thunder at all here, but I know that, you know, probably your what you're doing on YouTube is an ends to a means by promoting your books and promoting your show. And yeah, a lot of it, you know, you push people back to, you know, where scottsickler.com is, and you push them back to the link where they can pre-order your new book, upcoming Pandemic. And all that,
pandemic,
right?
I mean, and the last two videos we've done at YouTube have both been, one's been a pandemic trailer, and one has been the unboxing where we got the first copy and share that with the fans when I pull out the first copy out of the envelope and get to see it for the first time. And you're right, a lot of what we do on YouTube is primarily, it's twofold. Number one, it's to, you know, catch people who are there and have never heard of me, but look up, zombie novel, or look up The Walking Dead, and I happen to be the next video that pops up on the list, and they watch it, and then they're intrigued, and they go out and buy a book. And the other thing YouTube does for us is it's our embed code on our site. So all the videos we do, we record, we edit, we put them up to Libsyn, and they go into our podcast feed. So all the video I'm doing is primarily aimed at my subscriber base. And then we also put it up on YouTube because YouTube has excellent embedding tools and excellent sharing tools. But you are right that the primary goal of our videos is to make people aware of the brand, make people aware of the kind of books that I write, and hopefully find a connection where they're excited to go out and read one of these books and to drive traffic back to our website. That's the main thing we're trying to do. We're trying to maintain a community as much as we can at our website, while knowing that we have to be involved in the Twitter community, Facebook, Tumblr. I just got into Pinterest, which has turned out to be much cooler than I thought it was, and being in all these different places. But if we can get them to our website and lock them in so that we are able to communicate them on a regular basis, we have new books coming out, then that's the big win for us.
Rob, I know that you invited Scott not only because he's a long time in the space, but he's doing some cool stuff. I'll let you go ahead and jump in here.
Yeah, I just think it's really clear, you know, what Scott's trying to do here. He's using these platforms as a outreach vehicle to drive people back to his core offering, which is his books and his creative works there. And I think that that's really smart. And I think, but at Scott's core has always been podcasting. So I think that is the way that he's maintaining that relationship with his audience. And it's probably the podcast area probably fits a little bit better, Scott, with your readers and the actual a user base of your books. So would that be more accurate? Is that it tends to be a little older?
Yeah, we watch the demographics as much as we can from where we can see them, Google Analytics and Facebook, but you're right in that my primary job is I'm a novelist. I write hard science, horror, sci-fi, modern thrillers, all those genres combined into one thing. And we sell those books in bookstores, and you can say buy them all on Amazon as print, ebook, audiobook, etc. But what made my career was serializing these audiobooks and giving them away as a free podcast. And then later on, we added the advertising to the podcast. And the pitch is obvious. If you don't want to hear advertising, you can go buy the whole book, and that's fine. If you want a free audiobook, well, we run a couple of ads against it. But the podcast is still, that's my differentiator. That's my bread and butter. So if I can get people to go to the site and subscribe, or subscribe in iTunes, and every Sunday, like clockwork, they get an episode, and they're hooked on the story, that's what we're really selling, is the storytelling ability. So we're still big on podcasting. We still, every book we do that you can get in the store, you can get from my Scott Sigler audiobooks on iTunes or at scottsigler.com. You can still get all those for free as serialized audiobooks. And it still blows people away. People still come in and are like, wait a minute, you're just going to give me this whole book? You're not going to hide the ending from me? No, we give away the whole book. And now we've got like 14 novels and short story collections up on iTunes and at a site called patiobooks.com. Yep. And if people want to listen, they can go get everything. And what that does, the thing that really does for us is I have a decent brand name, but it's nothing compared to, say, Dean Koontz or Stephen King. So if people are on Amazon or going to a bookstore and they see a Scott Sigler novel and a Stephen King novel and they've only got their $15, well, you know, Stephen King's a more proven brand. They're going to probably take a chance on that one. As opposed to the podcast, which still brings me a ton of new readers, because now if they're looking online, well, I can spend $15 on this Stephen King audiobook, or I can go listen to this Scott Sigler thing for free and see if I like it. That's still a big advantage for me, for people to tune in for free. And a certain percentage of them that tune in for free, they hear exactly what they've always wanted to hear, and they love the stories, and I get a fan for life.
So, Scott, so have you ever thought about playing with the whole radio drama aspect of this for your books and things like that? Is that something that you've explored? I know that there's been some you know, successful series out there that have been dramatized as an audiobook. Is that something that you've thought about or explored?
Well, like the big one right now is We're Alive, which is a zombie podcast, and that's on the Nerdist Network. It's amazing product. But for me, I would not mind somebody adapting my stuff to a radio drama, but we put out an episode every Sunday and have for going up, closing in on 9 years now. And my primary job is to write stories. So we figured out a while ago, write the story, edit, rewrite, et cetera, get it ready for mass market hardcover, and then record that and then serialize it and put it out. That's the least amount of time involvement that I can do to make sure that we have consistent content in the feed. So producing a radio drama is a whole different ballgame. And
That's true.
It's crazy. If you can get 10 to 12 talented actors into a room several days to get them to record all this stuff, then you're probably more organized than I am. We've also heard there have been several where people have recorded remotely the radio drama parts, except, you know, in the middle of a dialogue, you can hear one lady's at her kitchen table and the other guy is, you know, outside, and the ambient noise throws it all off for me. So if I was going to do it, it would have to be in a studio like Casey Whalen does with We're Alive. That would be all I would do. That's like a full-time gig itself just to do that. So we've kind of found our niche and we're sticking to that.
Fair enough.
Scott, then, you know, on your, you know, when you started the podcast back in 2005, you know, you were one of the first that really kind of, you know, fixated, I guess, for a better word, on the, you know, turning your books into a sense an audio book, but it's really kind of more than that, isn't it?
Well, it's the serialized audio book, and you know, you can get an audio book anywhere. And so there were two other things that really helped with that. Number one, it was the author reading the book. We've only recently just started to go away from that because there's just not enough time in the day to write new content. Yeah. And, you know, we've got a couple of TV shows in the works, so we're, you know, focusing on other things. We've got some voice talent to do that. But for the first 7 years, it was the person who wrote the story reading you the story. And with, you know, not being a professional voice actor, no one cared. All they cared about it was like after three or four episodes, there was a perception that I was their buddy, I was their friend, and their friend was reading them a story, and they really liked the story. And that created a pretty intense emotional connection. People weren't just listening. People were advocates and going out and trying to spread the word. You know, if I put a book out online, they were sharing it in any way they could, and people are still doing that. So that was the big advantage. And another part of it was letting people peek behind the curtain to see how the career could develop. Because when I started, I had no book deal. I had nothing going on. I was just giving away these stories and telling people flat out, I'm giving you all of this for free to get you hooked on my fiction, so you have to come every Sunday and listen to it. I'm going to make you a junkie for the fiction. And I'm doing this to build an audience and sell a ton of books and be a flat-out capitalist. And people really ate that up. People were like, wow, he's not, you know, putting himself on a pedestal or pretending that this is very important work or a lot of the other tropes that sci-fi authors will roll out there. you know, he's a gangster. He's selling CDs out of the back of his car, so to speak, and he's here to try and build a career. And they've got to watch that career happen from when I put out an independent novel called Ancestor, which hit number one in print and in sci-fi and in horror at Amazon. That was a major accomplishment, and it wasn't, the audience was part of that. They were part of that process and part of that success, which then led to the 5-book deal with Crown, which then led to my book Contagious hitting the New York Times bestseller list. And at every step of the way, the audience, you know, felt like they were a part of it because they were a part of it. So my successes were theirs. And it just made it really fun and really exciting to watch a hardworking artist grow and attain success. So those are some things the podcast did for us. And being able to tell people every Sunday, hey, here, after the episode, I'm going to tell you about all this cool stuff going on. We've got TV interest. You know, we've got movie interest. We got this book coming out. And if people want to listen to just the story, they can. They can tune out. That's totally fine. But if they want to hear what's going on with the artist behind the scenes, they have that option too. And that creates really diehard fans.
So, Scott, are you doing self-publishing or are you working with a big publishing house? Just curious.
We do both. We just founded got our LLC papers all finished up for Empty Set Entertainment. And that is the company that publishes my Galactic Football League young adult series, which is Pro Football League 700 years in the future with aliens playing different positions based on their physiology. And but we put those out and all the associated novellas and short stories that go with those. And then I'm also writing, I'm with one of the big five. I write books for Crown Publishing, which is a division of Random House. And I write modern day horror thrillers. And those have been Infected, Contagious, Ancestor, Nocturnal. And on January 21st, Pandemic comes out. So it's a mixed bag. I get to do both things. I get to work with Random House and Crown and get to enjoy when they want to flex their marketing muscle or they want to do something in a store or they want to get the media's attention, they can do that. And then on the other hand, we are this sleek little pirate ship that's you know, sailing through the publishing seas, and we can do whatever we want, whenever we want. If we see an opportunity, we can go after it. We can invest in something, choose not to do what everybody else is doing. So I'm extremely fortunate in that building this career, we get the best of both worlds. Get to work with a big publisher, also get to try and participate in this exploding world of self-publishing and do whatever we can there to build a long-term business.
Scott, when I did my, I'm just kind of, if you can't reveal this, it's fine, but when I did my deal with Wiley for the podcasting book, one of the terms in there was if I did another book, they got first shot at it. Basically, it was a right of refusal type of thing. So do you have to, if you're going to do another, if you know, you got your stuff with Random House and what you're doing with them, but when you get ready to do an ebook, do you have to give them the first shot at these ebooks, or how does that work? How's your, you know, that goes in the business part of this, but how's that relationship work?
That hasn't come up yet, but it's about to. I had a 5-book deal with Random House. The 5th book, which is Pandemic, is out January 21st. And we've already written the next book, the next, what I call the big books. Like this is, you know, aimed at the large marketplace. And that one's called Flyer. And first week of January, the agent will send that off to Crown, and Crown gets first dibs. They get to look at it and make an offer on that book. As far as the Galactic Football League series and the short story collections that I put out as ebooks, Crown passed on those things. We said, hey, we got this Galactic Football League thing. Are you interested? And, you know, they're a great company, but they kind of like, oh, space football? I don't think so. We were like, all right, fair enough. It's a bit of a niche, you know, kind of a niche thing. Do you mind if we put these out on our own? And what we were doing, this is, you know, this is back to 2007. This is pre-ebook explosion. I mean, there right. wasn't even, I don't even think there were ebooks on Amazon at the time right. to show you how far back this was. And we said, we're going to do a limited edition hardcover run. We're going to do, this is pre-Kickstarter, but basically we did a Kickstarter. We sold to our audience and said, you guys have heard this book. We're going to do a really tricked out hardcover with 16 color plates. There'll only be 3,000 copies. Buy it now and we'll give it to you in 8 months. And like 2,000 people did. And we had a huge success with that. But we got permission from Crown to do that.
Right.
And they said at the time, they said, as long as the books aren't in bookstores competing with the titles that we put out and causing confusion in the marketplace, you can do whatever you want. So we've had kind of a 5-year grace period where my partner, A. Kovacs, and I have gone, okay, hardcover, we're also going to do the ebook, and we're also going to do the audiobook, and we're also going to put out a paperback.
Right.
And we sort of overstayed our welcome with Crown's generosity in that regard, but it hasn't turned out to be a problem because there's no confusion in the marketplace, and Crown's been super cool about that. So now that that window of opportunity is closing, yeah, now I have to give the book to Crown and see if they are interested in it. But the 5-book deal with Crown is almost done, and if they don't pick up Flyer, then I can do whatever I want. And if I make a deal with another big publisher, you know, that we're doing well enough as a company that I get to go in, you know, with what they call FU money. Yep. I get to go in and say, if you want to buy this book and put it out, right, I'll work harder for you than anybody else. But I also put out my own stuff. I also give it away for free as a podcast. If you want to do business with these things, that's great. If not, then pass on my book.
Because that's got to be, you know, I can just, because I was basically told, because I thought, you know, I'll turn each chapter of the book into a big, you know, I do a podcast, you know, they were like, well, we really don't want you doing a, you know, we don't want you going through each chapter step by step and, you know, putting it on because that's going to hurt book sales. That's, you know, that was 2005.
Right.
So, right. You know, and so they kind of had enough forethought to say, eh, we really don't want you doing this. And in hindsight, I should have fought for that like crazy because, you know, I probably would have made, I made great money off the book. Don't get me wrong. I did. It was a great experience, great exposure, you know, all the stuff that goes along with being published. But at the same time, there was the later on, you're like, oh, you know, you're just like, damn, that was a bad decision. You know, that was a bad business decision. So just, you know, it's one of those things probably that anyone that's getting this space has to look out for, you know.
And when we go forward with our next deal, we'll be very adamant that, these are my words. I wrote them and I'm going to give them away for free in serialized format.
Right.
And it shouldn't be a problem now because now we've got metrics to back it up. Like, look at my backlist sales, look at the sales that we do every month. And we're not Anne Rice.
Right.
Clearly we're not a household name. At the same time, we sell more than 95% of the authors that they put out where they, you know, hold on to all the rights and won't let them promote the way they want to promote. Yep. So, you know, like I said, we're sort of gangsters in this regard that we're going to do anything and everything to let people know about our book and hopefully find people that are so entertained by the work that they're like, oh, great, I got those for free. I'm going to buy everything else this guy puts out in print the day it's available. And we have thousands of those people, you know, like people just – because we gave it away for free and they got a chance to try it out on their own terms and not have to put their money out forward, now they're so grateful that someone respected them. And that's really what it comes down to is the next publisher we go with has to understand that we like our publishers and are happy our publishers pay us, but they are a second-class citizen to the reader and the customer. The people who pay their money in a bookstore or on Amazon to buy these books, those people are number one, and we're always going to cater to them. So, you know, we'll see. I'm sure there are some publishers that'll be like, oh, you're done giving stuff away. We're not going to do that. And be like, great, then we don't have a deal.
Right.
And then there'll be another publisher who's like, if you want to promote, we can't afford to promote as much as we'd like to. You go crazy, and then we'll make a deal, and everybody will be happy.
You know, I'm you know, just going back from my experience, and again, I only did this once, and it was a niche book. And obviously it was a techie book. It wasn't, and it didn't require any more skill than basically writing an instruction manual. It's just to be honest, that's kind of the way it was. But the sales numbers were pretty incredible. And I understand it was a hot time for podcasting, but at the same point, promoting it on my show, and of course I was doing a tech show, I wasn't doing a podcast show, but doing a tech show, and it just like, holy crap, it really drove the numbers. And I don't know why more artists or more authors don't do what you do, because it just seems to me like it's a proven form. You know, you got to be a good writer, number one. It's just like any podcast. If the words suck, they're not going to read it. You know, it's if the story sucks. But obviously, you're a great writer, so you know you've got that following. But I just don't understand why more authors aren't following your formula. Do you see people copying your formula?
You don't see a lot. And then the people who were doing it when I started out in 2005 to say 2008, most of those people aren't doing it anymore. Because it is a huge time investment.
Right.
You know, podcasting every week is a big time investment, and that's time you're not on the keyboard writing new copy, writing new content. So you don't see it as much anymore. And it does take, you know, it takes a certain personality to get on the mic every week. And with the goal, like your goal is I'm going to educate these people and show them all this super cool stuff. My goal is I'm flat out here to entertain you.
Yeah.
And you know, you have personalities associated with both styles. And some authors are just not comfortable on the mic exposing themselves. So you lose a lot of people there. Like, yeah, that's not my thing. That's why I write books. So I communicate that way. And that's great. The other reason I think it's dropped off a lot is because of the ebook explosion. In 2006, 2005, you know, podcasting was the only way to get your content out to a large audience at the speed of light, where people could just share it instantly with somebody with their social circle. That and, you know, the Cory Doctorow style of giving away your PDF of your book, for example. And now there's the ebook marketplaces of Amazon and Barnes & Noble and others. And now authors can have that same kind of speed of light global distribution with Amazon. And you don't have to necessarily do the podcasting to develop a large audience. And the guys and girls who are succeeding in that space, you know, the J.A. Conrads, the Blake Crouches, the Hugh Howies, et cetera, that are making crazy amount of sales numbers in ebooks. A lot of them doing that is selling the book for the first book in a series for 99 cents or flat out giving it away for free. There's some restrictions on Amazon as to how often and for how long you give a book away for free. But when there's an opportunity to do that, these guys are all over it because they understand that if you give it away for free and maybe 10,000 people download that book and only 10% of them go, wow, this is a good author, 90% say, this is crap, I can't believe I read this. You know, out of that 10%, you now have 1,000 new potential paying fans will buy everything that you put out. So the podcasting model is mimicked now over in the ebook area, except with the ebooks, you don't have to get in front of a mic and record a 40-hour audiobook and edit it and splice it up and be in, you know, doing that podcast for 2 or 3 hours every week. So they don't have the same kind of time investment, and that's a shorter amount of time for them to get back on the keyboard and write a new book.
Yeah, I understand. Go ahead, Rob.
Scott, so are you seeing younger authors kind of coming up and kind of embracing your strategy more? Is it a generational thing? Is that what you're seeing? Or I mean, is there at some point down the line the opportunity for podcasting to kind of come back more in the kind of book and literary space?
I think there's a great opportunity, and there's, you know, there's other stuff out there like Welcome to Night Vale is a huge podcast on iTunes right now, and that's a completely different kind of storytelling that you just, you know, it wouldn't make any sense in print the way it's coming out in podcasts. But in podcast, it's unique and people dig it. I think that it may have been a generational thing at one time, but now, you know, the podcasting has become prevalent enough for people to know what it is, even if they're not techie, and just to subscribe in iTunes. So people are doing it, and we still get occasional emails of people saying, how do I set up my fiction podcast? And we outline all the steps, and they say, thank you, I'm never going anywhere near that. You know, it's way too much work. But it really, for fiction, you know, you don't get that, I put out a book that's about this tech subject. Now I'm going to have my podcast and have guests on. We're going to talk about different things in the tech area. And that's a natural fit, and it works great. In straight fiction, it's not quite the same thing. You've got your story, and then you can have other people talk about creating a story or storytelling or other authors on, but there's a bigger disconnect between the story you wrote and what you can have as a chit-chat, which means it largely comes down to the author on the mic talking about the book, talking about what's going on. And for that, you need someone who doesn't mind the tech learning curve or already is tech tech oriented and is also a big ham. You know, you need somebody who likes to babble on the microphone because most of it's by yourself. You need someone who really likes responding to the fans who contact you via social media because of your podcast. You have to kind of want and court the spotlight to some extent. And some authors are love that, like me. I love the attention. I love talking to fans in any way, shape, or form. And other authors look at that and they see the reality of that's a lot of time where I'm not writing new stuff and I'm not spending time with my family and I'm not taking care of these other areas of the business. So it's there and people can do it and people still can have success with it. But it's, you know, it's a multi-year investment. We didn't see any real benefit from doing this until between years 3 and 5. And it was only after year 5 of every Sunday putting stuff out that we started to make it the cornerstone of our business.
So have you seen any fan podcasts pop up, you know, in support of a series of books?
Yeah. Well, okay. There's a We're Alive fan cast right off the bat. And yep. There were several Twilight fan casts and Harry Potter fan casts, which have all, I believe, faded out because the books are done.
Yeah.
We've had two. What we've had are fan fiction casts based on what we call the Siglerverse, because all my stories from modern day to a batch that's 500 years from now called the Crypt to 700 years from now, which is a Galactic Football League, they're all interlinked. So elements from all of those come back, and we have fans who come in and go, I'd like to write this thing on your timeline that you mentioned but didn't get to. Is that okay? And we're like, go crazy. As long as you don't sell it, you can write whatever the heck you want to write. And then we started to put those into our own podcast, the Tuesday Terrors podcast, which was edited by Ariok Morningstar. And it was great. And then after about 8 months of weekly stories, he moved on to other things. So that has pod faded for us. But you do see fan casts. We've had two around the content, and sometimes they're successful and sometimes not.
It's interesting, though, that what I just hit upon and something you said was that you actually had a fan continue on your storyline on a character that's something you didn't follow. That, to me, is like, that is, that is engagement and dedication and an epitome of, holy cow, you can't buy that. That's someone who is going to literally drive 1,000 people to buy your book. Just that one person.
And we get part of what the podcast does that the ebook angle doesn't do quite as well is that really personal connection.
Yeah.
And people hear your human voice every week and they hear the struggles you're going through to build your career and the sacrifices you make to go after the brass ring like this. And it's the human voice. They can hear everything you're going through. They can hear your emotion and they make that connection. Even though they're not actually spending time with you, they make that connection. And it drives people to express their love for the fiction in different ways. A lot of people do art. We have a ton of people who've gone out and gotten tattoos of different things, different elements from the book. We have people, people like, I'm so excited. I want to write something in this area because this is so much fun. And it brings me so much enjoyment every week. And people go do that. So the podcast does engender a certain amount of fan loyalty, of insane fan loyalty that I haven't seen in the ebook form. Guys who do ebooks regularly, like Hugh Howey, who's just a rock star right now, he does get a lot of really crazy diehard fans. But I think the podcasting and that connection with the human voice just makes more diehard fans than the ebook space.
I've just never been a big, I buy a lot of ebooks, but I don't buy audiobooks. To me, audiobooks, to me, it's, I have, when I want to read, I want to read, and I want to develop my own, thought process and emotion and everything that goes along with a book. So to me, that's the paradox, to read your book. I want to read your book. But at the same time, I guess it's personality based. Each person's different. I guess maybe I'd want to hear your emotion because that's what's going to come through and how you're going, because you're going to, you know what you, in your mind what you wanted to say in that part of a book. So that's going to come out in the podcast. But at the same time, that's some of the mystery of reading anyways. You develop your own, I guess, opinion or that's emotion.
Our goal is, you know, everything we put out, usually hardcover, always paperback, available on the podcast if you want to hear me babble
right.
and say ridiculous, nonsensical things, which is yep. what I do in the podcast.
So you serve all audiences.
Yeah, and then available as an audiobook because, I mean, 45% of our consumer base now is mobile. Like, it's amazing to watch what's happened in the past year. And then as an ebook. So, you know, your story about preferring to read it, and even that gets broken down. Some people only want paper. Some people only want ebook. It's a lot of work to put it out in all the different formats, but that's what we have to do because it's up to the customer to decide how they want to consume the content. We just hope we have it available in the format that they prefer.
Yeah, I mean, because I think it's really as simple as each person or each, you know, has their own way that they like to consume content, and I think you're really smart, Scott, for trying to cater to every one of those differences in human beings, right? Because that's really what we're talking about. Right. I'm the same way. I don't listen to audiobooks, but I read a lot, and I also still listen to podcasts that have a lot of, you know, that are long and all that stuff. But audiobooks do tend to be extremely long. I mean, some audiobooks are like, what, 20, 30, 40 hours long or something like that.
Yep.
So, I mean, it takes a significant time commitment on the part of the listener to engage with something like that and actually finish it, you know. And they're probably not listening to podcasts because all their time is being taken up listening to the audiobook. So, I mean, it's interesting.
And that runs the gamut. But Audible's booming right now. And Audible feeds into iTunes and feeds into Amazon. So Audible has a total... Amazon owns Audible now, but they've got a total monopoly in the marketplace. But the people who do listen to audiobooks are usually commuters, and they go through them like popcorn. And like a lot of the people I talk to, like, oh, that one's only 10 hours long. this one's 40 hours. I get to listen to the same story. And some people are, the longer it is, the better, because that means they, you know, can stay on one story for a full week's worth of commuting from Palo Alto to San Francisco. And it all depends on what the customer wants.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, Scott, why don't you tell us about your experience of taking your book and making it a TV show or movie or something like that. You said early in our conversation that you were working on some projects like that.
Well, this is number two and number three as far as those opportunities come. When I first put out Infected back in 2008 with Crown, and if people are new to your show and want to try out my fiction, that's the best one to start with, because the follow-up book is Contagious, and then the third book is Pandemic, which is out in January. And that got optioned immediately. Like, within 2 weeks, I had this crazy deal from Random House, and Random House Films and Rogue Pictures had optioned the movie rights, and I spent 2 years just trying to get something going with that, because it sort of fell by the wayside. They got a screenwriter that took 6 months to give them a draft, and they didn't like the draft. And then it took him another 6 months to come up with the second draft. I've still never seen the drafts of these things 5 years later. And, you know, and so there you go. The deal was absolutely killed because the screenwriter took way too long to get his work done, and Hollywood's a very shiny object place, and they had moved on. And then Relativity Media bought out Rogue Pictures, and, you know, the new guy in town said, well, we're getting rid of 23 of these 26 properties, and mine was one of the 23 properties. So, gone. All this excitement, all this buzz. I went down to Hollywood twice to meet with producers and try and see what I could do to help, and it just went away. So the next latest two things, one is for my most recent book called Nocturnal, and the other one is for Infected. So Nocturnal... God bless Amazon, I guess. The director or the producer of Hellboy and Hellboy 2 and Lethal Weapon 2 was reading a book, finished the book, and Amazon said, if you like this, maybe you like this. Infected popped up. He read Infected, and his name's Lloyd Levin, and he contacted us 2 weeks later and wanted to get the rights to the movie. And we thought it was somebody pranking us, quite frankly. You know, we look up the name, we're like, you're so full of crap. Who is this really? When we got a hold of him, I mean, this guy has, you know, and he did The Watchmen. So, and he's made some of my favorite movies. And he wanted to make it as a TV show. And that's been, gosh, 18 months in the works so far. But that one has been incredibly labor intensive because I've been writing the series Bible for him. So here's what was supposed to be a 10-page document is now 65 pages long. Synopsis of every episode, synopsis of upcoming seasons, timelines, character analysis, everything he needs to go into a production company and say, we've got, this isn't a one season thing. We've got a 5-season property we're looking at and everybody's going to make a ton of money and people will be entertained. That helps him go out and sell it. And the pilot script is done. It was written by Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson, who did a show called The Sentinel. So these guys have had a show on UPN that was 3 seasons long, which I've learned in Hollywood. If it makes it 3 seasons, it's a big deal. So great team behind this. And they're out pitching it right now. And hopefully we get a pilot made. And then the other one is Infected. And Infected is being looked at by the producers of Justified and Elementary. And we just got to go down to the set of Justified a couple days ago in L.A. and be on set and watch them shoot parts of an episode of Justified, which was awesome. So, you know, it's feast and famine, I guess. We go from movies optioned back in 2008, all this buzz, it's going to be a big deal. We're going to get Channing Tatum to play the lead role. Yay, this is so much fun. Then just boom, dead, done. Then nothing for 5 years, and now we're looking at possibly having 2 pilots shot in the next 6 to 12 months.
And you know, all this time, I think people need to realize the only way you're making a paycheck is with your sponsors and your book sales and whatever else you're doing. You don't get nothing till the movie gets, you know, I can't imagine this huge amount of work and then it flip-flop, either way it can go. And it's either you're in the money or not. And and it's not all about the money. I understand that, but you got to eat.
Yeah, yeah. And the series Bible for Nocturnal has been a fascinating process because, I mean, it's really fun and really cool to be working on one of these things. And working with Danny and Paul and Lloyd is, you know, I'm getting such an education on how these things are put together, which at some point I'll put into play in the future when I'm like, this is the TV show I'm going to do.
Right.
I'll have a lot of education. At the same time, it's been the same amount of work as writing a full-length novel and haven't seen a dime for it. And if the show doesn't get made, won't see a dime for it.
Right.
And that's the game. You know, you're swinging for the fences. You have to put everything you can into that. And, you know, Lloyd's the guy out there who's slugging away in the trenches trying to make this happen. It's my job as the creator to give him every possible tool that he can use to go out and try and make this happen so we can all make something really cool and really fun. But if the show doesn't get made, you know, I've literally lost 3 months of income and revenue because we were trying to make something to go after the bigger project instead of doing what A and I know how to do, which is write a book, edit a book, get the book into the store, sell the book.
Yeah, and it's also it's kind of fascinating to see what's happening between TVs and movies. And, you know, this is a little bit off the topic here a little bit, but it seems like that TV has really started to, or the small screen has really started to kind of take over the mantle of being where all the creative kind of groundbreaking kind of storytelling is going on right now. It feels like movies are kind of like kind of falling behind what's happening with TV. I don't know, what's your observation of that, Scott?
I think I heard Chris Hardwick say this about a year and a half ago, guys. He's like, we're in it. We're in the golden age of television, of dramatic television. And yeah. I think that was spot on. That was right on the money. I mean, you look at Mad Men, The Walking Dead, Breaking Bad, Justified, True
Blood.
Just go
through.
I mean, the shows that are, you know, and shows I haven't even caught yet, like The Shield and The Wire, Oz, it goes on and on. That people are able to make long-form storytelling and they're no longer limited by a network saying, we need this episodic. I need to be able to play these shows in any order and every show buttons up nicely. Like SVU, Special Victims Unit, which every episode is completely done. You can play them in totally different order, and it doesn't really matter. But long-form storytelling with villains and plot arcs that are going all the way through. You know, Battlestar Galactica was very influential in that. That has become a new art form where you can take 12 hours to tell a story, and you don't have to be limited by, well, we need to make this as broad as possible to get as many different kinds of butts in the seats as possible. And movies are still very much hampered by the studio system that is going to water down everything in order to make it as broadly appealing as possible. So TV is really where the great stuff is being made right now. You know, like in the Dexter concept, this is going to be a 12-hour long movie with a lot of cool beats in the process, but it's a 12-hour long movie as opposed to, okay, you got 90 minutes to tell your story and then you're out. And when Lloyd came after Nocturnal, he wanted to make a movie. And like, this is the dude who made Watchmen, you know, which is just eye candy crazy. I'm like, this will be awesome. I love it. Then about 3 months into the process, he called and was, you know, all conflicted. He's like, well, I know you're not going to want to hear this, but I really think we'd be better off. The story would be better off if we made it a TV show. And I was like, that's awesome. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. I don't want to see the story butchered in 90 minutes.
Right.
If we do it in a TV show, I'm in. He's like, well, it's less money. I'm like, I don't care. I want to make the best product that we can make. So I totally agree with you, Rob. TV is really where it's at, and people have freedom to make amazing stuff. And particularly the cable networks are letting people go. They're letting the creators create. And there's still a ton of control. Don't get me wrong. The showrunners for The Walking Dead ride herd on that show and say what you can and can't do. And they are totally in control. But they give the directors and the writing team a lot more freedom to make something that you would have never seen that show 10 years ago. You just wouldn't have seen it.
It's interesting that you said that the money's less with TV. But I you know, based on my experience, you know, I go to a movie and I forget it.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, many times I don't know who wrote the script or what the story came from. But on a series, you know, you look at The Walking Dead, you look at some of the HBO stuff that's out there, you know, and if there's a book associated with it, I am generally ahead of the series with my, you know, I read it maybe a season ahead. From a book standpoint. So I think I agree with you. I think the TV series, the TV story series has more career value for you than maybe the movie. Am I wrong in that thinking?
No, I think that there are some movies being made of books that do really well, but those are absolute juggernaut sales-wise books. Twilight, Hunger Games.
Right.
Things of that nature, and books that are just a couple of notches below that, like, you know, Beautiful Creatures series, etc., come out and don't do very well in theaters at all because they're, you know, they're butchering the story to get it down to 90 minutes. That's a really difficult task to do. And TV, you know, the True Blood and Dexter, even though they've gone away from the book significantly after the first book or second book, there's still so much more room to tell that story. And the money is much smaller up front. Like, we're going to option your book for a TV show. Here's a couple of grand. Okay, great. And as opposed to, we're going to option your book for a $300 million movie. That's a bigger paycheck. But that after that movie's done, you're done. Whereas in TV, if it goes to three seasons, you know, you're talking about the author and the creators making a lot more money in the long run, which is why you see such big name Hollywood actors getting into TV now too. Cause now everybody sees if that show goes 3, 4, 5 years, they're going to make a lot of money and make residuals for a long time and really become more stable.
Yeah. The syndication stuff, it'll pay huge.
Yep.
So, you know, so just going on a movie that's in the theaters right now, Ender's Game. And I read Ender's Game. I saw Ender's Game and it really pissed me off. They really missed strong essences of that book that, you know, there was a whole segment in there. I'm like, man, you just cut out, you know, 50% of the emotional value of that storyline because you just had to chop it because you didn't have enough time. So I thought the adaptation to the book was horrible. It got the point across, but at the same time, I hate it when books are butchered like that in the movies.
Yeah. I didn't I mean, I thought the performances in that movie were good and some of the special effects were good, but yeah. having been a giant fan of that book,
yeah,
it was really disappointing. Yeah. They seemed to miss on so many levels what was going on. And then what was weird to me is some of the more subtle elements of the book that you can get from reading the book, but needed to be more heavy-handed with the movie. They sort of took the heavy-handed stuff from the book and made it subtle, and the subtle stuff from the book and made it heavy-handed, and just kind of missed getting the message across in a lot of different ways. So,
yeah, it's.
But at the same time, you know, when it turning a book into a screenplay, either for TV or for the movies, now that I've got to watch that process happen a couple of times, it's a whole different skill set, man. It's really difficult to do. And I feel bad for the guys and girls who have to adapt a book, even a short book like Ender's Game, which is really short,
yeah.
adapt that for a 90-minute movie. That's a really complicated task to pull off. And then as soon as they write it, you know, the director's nephew comes in and gets to write on the screenplay, and then executives come in and go, oh, what, can we just cut out the whole military angle and have a kid in space? Like, you literally get people coming in with no knowledge of the source material who want to make all these changes. And it's amazing a movie gets made at all. And and when it's a good movie, it's mind-blowing that they actually pulled that off.
Yeah, and there is definitely magic that happens on certain books. And, I would almost, you know, you probably can almost write a book on the process here, you know, because there's very few people that talk. Well, the people in the business know the process, but from an outsider standpoint, I have no clue the steps that people go through to get from point, you know, from here to the finished product. You know, what we see on television is, you know, can't imagine the back work that goes along with that. So that to me is a podcast in itself, just talking about that process.
I think that's why the comic movies have enjoyed so much success lately, because the source material is a much shorter story. You know, comic book has a lot less pages than a novel, and people are able, like, you know, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies were able to just kind of go with that basic origin story and alter it to some extent, but there's not as much there. You don't have to cut stuff out, and you can pay more attention to the stuff that is there because you've got the time to do that. Or, you know, the Avengers or Marvel's whole strategy of building all of these movies up into one giant thing. So and nothing you do is going to make all the fans happy. People are already ticked off about the casting of Wonder Woman and Batman, and we haven't even seen those people on the screen yet. But, it, you know, the longer the source material, the harder it is to make a good movie about it, which is why Game of Thrones has had so much success on TV, because the writing team has the opportunity to really get into a lot of the nuances of the characters and show those great things that George R. R. Martin created.
Rob,
to pull this back to podcasting a little bit again, I followed the whole Breaking Bad thing, and I got a couple years behind, but I caught up really quick on binge viewing, right?
Yep.
Which is very popular now. But one of the fascinating things that I saw about that series in relation to podcasting is that the Breaking Bad series had an official podcast, right, that was done by Vince and some of the producers and the folks that were doing the editing, and they'd bring in some of the stars from the show. And then I also saw a bunch of fan podcasts, right? There was just like, there was probably like 15 or 20 fan podcasts that were covering the series. But this official podcast, they would get in there, and I found that the official podcast was not as engaging as the fan podcast. And one of the big reasons is that the official podcast, they were always talking about kind of inside the ballpark kind of topics, and they could never speculate on the storyline because that would be construed as leaking, you know, stuff. But on the fan side, they could speculate up and down. They could talk about different characters in a way that the official podcasts couldn't. I thought that was a really fascinating thing.
It's really tricky to do that official podcast because they do know what's going to happen. And even though you can get Bryan Cranston on And Brian Cranston's a phenomenal podcast guest. I've heard him on a couple of shows. Even though you get him on, and that's what everybody wants to hear from, they can't talk about things as much as the fans, who can just go crazy. And there's probably going to be more resonance with fans talking to other fans about the show than creators talking about what limited things they're allowed to say about behind the scenes. So it's what, you know, the former is organic and dynamic and exciting, and the latter is sterile and constricted, and probably spend more time hearing people say, oh, we can't talk about that, than you hear them throwing out crazy theories. I think I could be wrong in this, but I think Battlestar Galactica was the first show to have an official podcast. Like, we are the producers and we're going to talk about this show. And Lost had one as well. So, I mean, that's, you know, we're going on a lot of years of people seeing the opportunity there to get out and connect with the audience.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the producers of the show, but I thought it was really forward thinking on the part of Breaking Bad to actually do that. And I, Scott, you're exactly right. There has been other series that have done that, but they're pretty rare, actually. And I actually talked to some folks back when I was working a little closer with NBC folks back in the earlier days of podcasting, about trying to get them to do an official podcast for every TV series that they put out. And I was really, really pushing them towards doing that. And one of the big reasons that they didn't do that, and they thought it was a good idea, but one of the key reasons they didn't, was the fact that all of the contracts that they wrote with all of their folks, the producers and things, did not involve doing any kind of outside the ballpark kind of content creation. So it wasn't part of the contract, right? It's because everything that a producer does with a series has to be, or at least it has been, has to be part of the contract. So have you seen that conversation as well?
No, I haven't seen too much of that. I mean, the biggest factors of that I can think of are the time involved. You know, what little I know about making television, it's a very labor-intensive process, and people are working a lot of long days, and you have to bring people from a lot of different areas together. And then while they're doing that, say, by the way, come sit down for half an hour to an hour, and we're gonna blab about this, seems to be a lot to ask. But at the same time, that's the one area where the producers get to come out and be the focal point. Showrunners, producers, writers, people who are normally behind the scenes. And in modern days, people are much more familiar now. People know the name Vince Gilligan. In the same show 15 years ago, no one would have had any idea or cared who the producer was, because that just, you know, wasn't part of our cultural consciousness. Now people want to know who is the brain behind the show, not just the faces on the screen. So it's a great opportunity for those guys to get out and get more branding and get more exposure, and hopefully jump into the next show, because they're an established property. But if I was running a show trying to get everybody corralled to do a regular podcast, seems like that would, in addition to the contractual things, the time commitment would be a lot to ask.
But yet, Vince was able to pull it off. Now he has a reputation going way, way back to X-Files and things like that, and has had a huge following for many, many years. And maybe that put him in a different position to be able to take advantage of that. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, he's got what's considered by a lot of people one of the best TV shows ever. And now the podcasting is available. And if podcasting had been bigger back in the X-Files, maybe we would have seen the same thing. But I got a chance to meet Vince briefly at Comic-Con. And, you know, you can just tell that he's going to be the kind of guy who'd be really good at this. He's happy, he's relaxed, he's, eloquent, and he can sit down at that mic and just blab about the storytelling process. And that's going to be captivating and entertaining stuff. So like everything else, it does come back to who the person on the mic is, and if they really want to do it, and if they're going to be excited about doing it.
Oh, yeah.
He seems like the kind of guy who is.
Let's talk just a little bit about something that I don't think I've ever seen before, and that's a book trailer. And I don't know if we can put this up on the screen. If I play probably more than 10 seconds, we're going to get whacked by a copyright violation, but I can probably start it for just a little bit.
Well, I own the copyright, so that should be okay.
Yeah, YouTube is just really, it's just beyond anal what they have gotten into. But anyway, long story short, you did a book trailer, which I watched it this morning. I was like, damn, I want to read that book.
I guess that's the point, Todd.
But I've never seen this before. Are you guys the first to do this?
Oh, no. We've been doing them way back when. We did one for Infected. And if anybody wants to see these, they're all up at my site. So scottsigler.com/the name of the book, there will be a book trailer there. So /infected/contagious. The one you were just showing now is /pandemic. They're all searchable on YouTube. So the first one we did was 2008 for Infected. And so we've been doing it at least since then. People have been doing book trailers a little bit before that. Most of the book trailers were horrible. They were a floating book cover and then fade into some text and there's some, you know, music in the background. And they didn't do anything about conveying the intensity of the book. So there's a lot of really crappy book trailers out there. I am not an expert on how long people have been doing this or how many people have done it, but back around 2007, 2008, 2009, people started to be like, let's just shoot a mini movie. Let's do like a 30-second to 2-minute movie or a scene from the book and then cut in all the book information. And let's just shoot a movie trailer, but make it for the book.
Right.
So more people are doing that. There have been some really, really well-done ones, mostly by the big publishing houses, like the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter book trailer, well before there was a movie, was they must have spent $100,000 on that thing. It's phenomenal. You know, it's like it's a full-on action scene with Abraham Lincoln duking it out with the John Wilkes Booth. And, you know, you can spend as much money as you want to on those. We do all those ourselves. So the budgets are much, much smaller, and finding a way to make it compelling is important. But the book trailer to me is the single best value for the dollar you can get in promoting a book, because Pandemic's coming out and Crown's doing a bunch of cool stuff. You know, we're going to do like a Reddit AMA and we've got some online advertising. We're doing a book tour and a lot of cool things. But come February, all of that stuff goes away forever. We've got 1 week in January where my name will be out a lot more than it normally is. Come February, all of those things go away and they will never be seen again. A book trailer sits on YouTube and continues to get view after view after view. And some people are going to see that totally by accident and go, oh, I want to read that book. That looks awesome. And the Infected trailers got like 250,000 views and still gets hundreds of views a week. And that book was out in 2008. So, I mean, it's still producing hits. It's still bringing in, getting new exposures and hopefully getting new people to look at the book. And it will sit there forever until YouTube goes away. So it's an excellent way to spend money to promote a book.
And yeah, you said you did the trailer in-house. Can I ask what it cost you to produce your trailer?
Our budget for each trailer has been about $5,000 per trailer. This year for the Pandemic one, we got crazy and spent $6,000. But so we dedicate a percentage of book revenue. Like, we make X amount of money per book. A certain percentage of that is going to go to our own promotion. And almost without fail, we spend, you know, that's how much we are. All the money we have earmarked for promotion all goes towards the trailer. We have found that Random House has not really embraced the trailer concept. They don't want to spend money on it. They're more than happy to take what we produce and pimp that around as much as they can. They're very excited to have authors involved in the promotion and making their own assets. But to make that happen, that's largely been on us to make it happen. So, and I can relate, because the big publishing tends to see things in cycles, and that 1 month of promotion, and then they don't think about it anymore. But they haven't really caught on to the long tail of promotion, and that these trailers just sit there and continue to improve your backlist sales for years. I mean, I bet 10 years from now, I'll still be getting a couple hundred views a week on the Infected trailer. So that's 250,000 people have been exposed to the book for $5,000. That's a pretty good deal.
And, you know, those follow-on years is, you know, as you write more books, you know, that becomes, you know, a bottom line each year that you get in a check that's a royalty check. And, you know, people don't realize, and maybe folks that have published books understand that, but you get a report. Wiley sends it to me every about this. It should be coming any day now. And my stuff now doesn't sell anything because it's long in the tooth. But yeah, I get this report. It tells me how many returns, how many sales, how many ebooks, how many hard. So it just gives me the rundown, and that's, you get that every year. And if you're lucky, there's a check attached to it from a royalty standpoint. But that could be end up, you know, that trailer, you know, may over the years, you know, increase your royalty payments by, you know, add a couple zeros to that every year.
It really is about the backlist, and that's, backlist is defined, those, the books I wrote from 2008 right. to 2012 aren't all on shelves everywhere anymore, right. and they're still on Amazon. So you're trying to drive that backlist sales, and yeah. that's what publishers are shooting for. They swing for the fences all the time. You know, Crown will, Random House will put out 150, 200 books this year and throw them against the wall and wait to see which one sticks. Then they'll put money behind it and try and make all their money on two or three of those
right.
books. That's the one angle. The other angle is they pay attention to the backlist sales. How, you know, when we're no longer spending marketing money on this guy and we've already paid this guy's advance and we're done, is there still revenue coming in from people finding this book in other ways? And trailers are the only way I know to drive, really drive backlist sales, aside from just writing really kick-ass books that people like. And when they read it, they're like, oh, I got to have more of that author. I got to have more of what she wrote. And then they'll go find your backlist. But yeah, trailers are, our strategy with trailers is, A and I, my business partner, A and I, we're trying to think, you know, 50 years ahead, basically. 50 years from now, when we're old and crotchety, we still are looking for ways that people will be buying this book I wrote right. 50 years prior and right. still reading it and still enjoying it.
Yeah. And hopefully getting some money for it.
Hopefully so, we're Scott, getting some money for it. But, you know, we're putting out anywhere from 2 to 3 full-length books a year right now. So, and we've got, you know, 15 in the marketplace right now. Another 5 years, we're going to have a lot of books, a lot of different series, a lot of different entry points for people to come and discover my writing. And, you know, the more books you have, the more books you sell. So trying to get a little bit of money from each of those books, make the book as good as it possibly can be so it stands a test of time and people will still enjoy it when it's long in the tooth, which you can get away with in fiction. And you know, when we've got 20, 30, 40 books, 40 titles out there, 40 properties, we only need to make a little bit from each one for us to have a sustainable business.
Oftentimes, I'll find, at least from a consumer, this is my how I buy books, is that I look for series, especially I read a lot of sci-fi, so I look for a series, and generally I look for series that's been out a while, and because I don't like just read one, I want to read 5 in a right. row, because it's just like, I was a big Robert Jordan fan, you know, he died before he finished his series, yeah. and you know, so someone had to come in and finish up his last two books, and he did a good job doing them. But you know, so, and it was over 15 years or something that series, and it drove me nuts. You know, you get one book a year. But I was, my thing is now, as I look for authors that are boom, 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 putting books out on a regular basis, and I'll buy 5 books at one shot.
Yep.
If I buy the first one, read it. Oh, I love that, man. Let me get 2 through 6. Do you see, and I know we're way off the podcasting track here, but do you see statistics on that where someone, of course, you probably don't see it in the reporting. They really don't break it down that way.
Well, you see it. You see it in the Amazon store. You know, you see it with J.A. Conrath series and Blake Crouch and people I've mentioned before. And you see it a ton in sci-fi with ebooks on the Amazon right. store. In that, if it's an author's got one title up, that's a really difficult sell.
Yep.
And yes, people succeed with one book and do very well and can blow up. You know, like Hugh Howey can blow up from his book Wool, but it, the magnifier, the multiplier comes when you go to that page, like, oh, who's this Hugh Howey guy? And you go look on his page and like, pop, 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 there's six books in a series. And you know, now what you get on Amazon is people will download that 50-page sample. And if they like that 50-page sample, they click the button, they buy all 6, they're all on the Kindle and they buy them like crazy. So the more books you have, the more yep. perceived validity you have as an author.
Yep.
And there's always this element of, oh, she wrote 7 books. She's got to be good.
Right.
Like, that's an automatic reaction that we all have, even people who are in the game and know the business.
Yep.
And that lowers your fear of buying a book that is going to wind up being bad and wasting your money. And then the other thing is, if you can see that series, yeah, that series is all done. 5 books in a series, you can buy them all, knock them out. that's great, you know, and hopefully you don't have to get Brandon Sanderson to come in and finish your series because you get hit by a bus.
Right.
But yeah, people want, and we're excited about that from our, and this is sort of back on the podcasting front, our Galactic Football League series, which is YA. It's a ton of fun. Real sci-fi coming of age story, kind of the traditional hero's quest, but set in the future. And we've got 4 books in the series. And since we're doing them ourselves, we've kind of been spotty about getting them up in all the different stores. And come sometime in January, we're going to have all 4 books in the Audible store, all 4 books in the Kindle ebook store, Barnes & Noble, all 4 books in paperback. They're sold out in hardcover. And we haven't even really begun to market this series yet because we've seen the same thing that you've just been talking about. We don't want to spend our money and effort marketing these things until a guy like you goes to the Amazon store and is like, oh, shoot, 4 books with the 5th one coming out in a month, and just boom, buy them all.
I always read the first one. If I'm hooked at the end of one,
yep.
And I don't even buy, you just talked about the samples. You shouldn't have told me about that. I don't even look for that. and that relationship thing that Amazon gives you too. If you like this, you'll like that. I'm going to tell you that's been pretty, it's drained my credit card.
And some of the brilliance in marketing going on the Amazon store is it's amazing. I mean, I keep talking about J.A. Conrath, but he sold an enormous amount of ebooks and has innovated a lot of ways to market his books. And like, you can buy Whiskey Sour as one book, or you can buy these first 3 books in the series together for this much, or you can buy the 5 books for this much. And he's got different ways to sell the same book, so they look different and at different price points, just trying to catch the eye. He's trying to cater to what people want to see. Some people just want one book and they're going to buy it and read it. Some people get sucked in like, oh, I could buy all 4 at once. This is great. So there's a lot of different ways to present that information.
You know, I think the thing that amazes me is, and I don't think I'm going against anything I ever signed to say this, but when I did my book with Wiley and they came back, told me that I was their number one Extreme Tech series bookseller. In other words, I sold the most books of any of the books they'd done in Extreme Tech series. And my book did about 45,000 copies, softback cover. They were all soft. They weren't hard. Did 45,000 soft and a significant number digital when the digital came out later. And I thought to myself, how are they making any money? They obviously made money because I got my advance was paid off and I got some more money. But how, you know, to me, I'm thinking, okay, if mine was number one, how did they make money on those other 10 prior? I guess it's the same type of thing. You keep throwing stuff at the wall and hoping something's going to stick. But if mine was number one and those other 10 that were behind me that were on different topics didn't sell that many, I'm thinking, how in the world did they make cash?
Well, the number I've heard bandied about anecdotally, and I don't have any facts to back this up, but what we usually hear is that publishers lose money on 90% of the books that they put out. It's a crazy, crazy business model. As a small business, we've made a good profit on every book we put out right from square one because we do the pre-order thing. Right. We get all the money in before we even print the book.
Yep.
So we're trending well above industry standard, but we're also, you know, we've got five books out and then 3 ebooks on top of that. So it's not the same thing. Crown's putting out hundreds of books every year. Random House puts out 100 books every year. And the model in publishing for many decades has been, we're going to put out a ton of books and lose money on 90% of them, and we're going to hope our top 2 or 3 books for the year make enough money for us to be profitable and keep everybody in their expensive New York offices. It still seems to work that way.
Their expenses have to have went down because everything's, you know, a large amount of the sales are digital now. So, you know, they don't have to go to, you know, that was one of the things that, you know, blown me away is we were scheduled for a certain publishing date and we got insider information that another book was coming out. Somebody called me, told me they're writing a podcasting book and made a mistake of telling me what their publishing date was. And I was still under lock and key to not tell anyone that I was writing a book at the time. And I called the publisher and said, hey, so-and-so at such and such publisher is going to be released on this date. And he's like, dude, can you be done in like 3 weeks? I said, well, yeah. He says, because if you are, I can move and shift the publishing and get you on the press. And I think, oh, yeah, this thing still had to go get pressed. And he says, we'll shift you and we'll run, do your run and we'll have you in store 6 weeks before they are. And I was like, okay. But to me, it was kind of funny. But in today's age, they could care less, because if sometimes they're just going to make the book only an ebook anyway. They're not actually going to make physical copies. So I'm sure the risk has went down. But to me, it was pretty hilarious that they had to shift the printing schedule to get me out and move the publishing. And it was a big deal. They moved the release date up 90 days. So, you know, that to me, that was a little telling.
Yeah, they call that crashing the book, and they crashed it to get out a quicker deadline.
Yeah.
Again, something that rarely comes up, and that's more nonfiction, comes up in fiction,
right?
Unless you're, you know, both writing something about the same topic. But it you would think that costs have dropped because of the ebook thing, but publishing fought the ebook thing tooth and nail. My primary career as a full-time author happens to have coincided directly with the ascent of ebooks, and watching publishers crap their drawers over what ebooks are going to do was really weird. You're like, but because I'm a digital kid. I'm like, but you don't have to pay any money to make it. It's just ones and zeros.
Right.
And it's been trippy. And since then they've all, the biggest problem right now with ebooks and publishing is people want to pay $2.99 or $4.99 for the ebooks. And most people are savvy enough to go, why would I pay $20 for ones and zeros when the Amazon discounted print book is $15? It doesn't make any sense. There's still a lot of confusion in publishing about how to manage pricing so that they don't cannibalize their hardcover sales. But which also still doesn't make sense to me. Even as an insider, I don't get it, because if you sell an ebook for $5, that's at least $4.50 of clear, pure profit.
Profit.
You're home free. And the print book, you sell my Pandemic's going for like $20 on Amazon in pre-order. And, I'll see a dollar from that. And the publisher's probably going to make a dollar on that, $2 on that after they factor out all their costs. So you would think they would love ebooks up one side and down the other.
You know, I live here in Hawaii. You live in San Francisco. Space is of a premium. We don't get 4,000 square foot homes in Hawaii unless you're like a Bill Gates or someone like that. So in my entire library is of stuff that I have that's actually in hardcover is one bookshelf. But my kids have little bookshelves, and we just don't have room for paper no more, and people's lives move around. So, you know, if it's digital, I can, you know, here's the iPad, here's the Kindle, go read it. And, you know, we're truly 100% digital in this family. I don't think we have very many paper books. That they go to the library and get paper books, but they can check out stuff digitally there too. So to me, it seems with audio, I mean, with it's, you know, what's the delivery cost? A cent.
The cat's already out of the bag. Yeah. We're totally looking at everything. We're in the middle of everything changing, and you still see a few studies sneak out like, well, actually kids prefer to read stuff on paper now, so therefore the whole digital revolution is over. And it doesn't even make any sense. These devices that we walk around with us all the time now do everything. They're our calendar, they're our email, they are contacts, they are books, music, video, everything, podcasts, everything that you could want. And the natural progression of having this personal assistant on you at all times, if you can also get your books there, people are going that way. And as your phones get a little bit bigger and easier to read, this is something I've been talking about since 2008, which is you're going to see the majority of books consumed as digital books, mostly on phones. People love their iPads and love their Kindles, but you don't always carry those with you. People are going to get used to reading on phones, and that's where a lot of your books are being sold. So our business, A&I, Empty Set still does print books because that's what people want, because there are people in the Midwest with giant bookshelves room to fill them. And we try and promote those, but when those are sold out, those are sold out. But the ebook lives on forever and doesn't cost anything to warehouse, and that's where our business is going in the next 5 years.
The only books I buy are ones that I want signed. Those are the books I buy, And I'll be honest with you, for a while I wasn't buying books. I'd go into Barnes & Noble's. This was before the digital space, and I would pick out, man, here's one. And next thing I got $200 worth of books here. Oh, man, let me put five back.
Yep.
You know, and even though I wanted them desperately, five went back on the shelf and I went to the cash register and you know, wonked down $100. I can now justify buying those, you know, those extra five books, even though they might be $7, I can justify that expense. So I think you've got more people that are going to be willing to buy digitally than I would love to see that statistic. I'd love to see the actual volume numbers, what they've done, because I know it's got to be extraordinarily high. It has to be. It's huge.
It's getting there. And, you know, the thing with that is that caters to the reader, which is why we love it so much. I would, you know, our tricked out hardcovers are $30 a pop. They're really expensive. Right. They take up a ton of space, but a lot of people want those as keepsakes, yep, and they want to get them signed, and that's all good and fine.
Yeah.
But the same book, the same exact book as an ebook is $5.
Right.
So for the cost of one hardcover, you can buy the whole series, and we make more from the ebooks. The biggest thing that people get is we just flat out make more.
Right.
We make more from selling a $5, you know, especially with Crown. I make more from selling a $5 ebook than I do from selling a $30 hardcover with them. And
because I'm going to buy you digitally. I'm not going to buy you hardcover. So that, yeah, you know, if it wasn't available digitally, you wouldn't make, because you would get zero, because I wouldn't have spent the money.
And we're in the entertainment business. I would rather you buy five books, yep, and read those books and have them, read them in any way you want, wherever you want them.
And your next
and
10.
Hey, I've got the chance to own your brain. I will own your brain and have you ready for the next Scott Sigler book that comes out. So yep, we dig it.
Love it.
But also, it seems like one of the big things too, you know, as being an author, Scott, that having a physical book still has a certain amount of prestige, I would think. And it's like, you know, people still like, from an author perspective, and I think from a media perspective, for an author to have a physical book, it's like people like to possess something that kind of has a physical presence to it, right, too. That's one of the challenges of all things electronic is that they're so small and so perceived to be kind of less significant. It's the same thing that happens with other parts of broadcast media, you know, TV, radio and stuff. Podcasting is always kind of subservient to that because of that prestige factor. It's classic. It's been around for so long. Uh-huh. Do you see that changing with books, where books become viewed as kind of like passé? Is that coming at some point in the future, actual physical book?
I don't think the physical book is ever going to become passé, and we're never going to see 100% adoption of ebooks. It's going to probably level out at about 60% ebooks, 40% print long term, because people are different and different people want different things. But yeah, absolutely. Like, I just did a video on, you know, pulling out the first hardcover copy of Pandemic. And it was like, holy cow, look at this, you guys. Look, the cover's bumpy. They embossed this. And it's tactile and it's very exciting. And there's a lot of prestige to it for a certain percentage of the marketplace. What's changing is, there's two elements to it. What's changing is there's a lot of people now who they don't care if there's a print book.
Yeah.
They go to the Amazon store to fill up their Kindle. They look at Scott Sigler and Stephen King, and like, they look exactly the same right next to each other. So there's no difference in perception in that this one's just an ebook and this one's in bookstores everywhere. And the other part of that is the growth of print on demand. You know, now like a lot, like Hugh Howey's Wool, for a while, now it's a Simon & Schuster book, I think, but for a while, if you wanted a print copy, buy the print-on-demand copy, and it gets shipped, and when it shows up, it looks exactly like everything you would buy in a bookstore. The only limitation to that has been really nice hardcovers, but I think we'll also see that start to come down, because print-on-demand hardcovers are prohibitively expensive right now, but in the next 5 years, that'll probably come down. And then that barrier of, is it ebook, is it print? The customer never sees it. They go to Amazon and they buy my book as a trade paperback that's done in print on demand. And it looks exactly like the Stephen King trade paperback where they printed 80,000 copies of it. And the customer never knows the difference. So an enormous amount of this is the perception, what the audience's expectations are, and the perception. And since more people buy books at Amazon now than buy in bookstores, you know, they don't see the difference. They want a print book, they get a print book. They have no idea it was made just for them.
Rob, we're almost out of time. Can you believe that?
I know. We've definitely struck on a topic that has a lot of discussion points. So do you see like the Barnes & Nobles and the Borders and other kind of physical world bookstores kind of having a presence going forward?
Well, I think indie bookstores, surprisingly, will continue to have a good presence. Like my favorite bookstore is Borderlands Books in San Francisco, and you can go in there and there's notes on every book, and the book staff is extremely knowledgeable and they're ready to help you, and you see the same faces 4 years, you know, 4 years ago I see the same faces when I come in today, and those seem to be doing pretty well, particularly with the death of the Borders bookstores. Now there's, if you want actual people to give you information on a book and you want that social connection, indie bookstores are where to go. Barnes & Noble's doesn't seem like they're doing all that well, and I don't know that they're going to be around for a long time. And I really, it's out of my expertise to say whether they're going to be there or not. I hope that they are, because a lot of book sales still happen from people going into a bookstore to browse and look around and find stuff. But if those stores go away, you'll see an increase in people searching on Amazon and people, you know, like on Goodreads and library and, you know, all these different sites online where you get that same sense of community. You just get it digitally. So I think we're going to see, we'll continue to see some level of bookstore for quite some time, but that ship has sailed. You know, the day of the mega bookstore dominating the industry is either already gone or on its way out.
So what you're saying is that more than likely it'll just be Amazon and maybe community-based bookstores? Is that what you're saying? More likely?
That's what it looks like to me. And I think at some point you're going to get some kind of competitor for Amazon to come in, but it's really hard to imagine that happening right now because they're so good at what they do.
Yeah, I mean, they sure are.
That store's fantastic, and the things are affordable. The things are easy to find. Their analytics as far as predicting what you're going to like is sensational, and they have a great service at affordable prices, and they deliver fast. They do all these cool things, and it's super fun. People love to shop at Amazon, and then you're going to get your community bookstore for the people who don't, and that's pretty much what it's going to wind up being, is the one juggernaut, and then other people on the periphery doing the best they can. But you know, the indie bookstore thing is a really difficult business, and I've talked to people at Borderlands and other stores. And people will ask them, well, what's going to happen when, you know, 90% of people are buying books on Amazon? And their answer is, it doesn't need to be 90%. If it's like 2 or 3 or 4 more percent, our margins are already so slim that if we lose that extra 2 or 3%, we can't afford to be in business anymore. So it's really challenging for the indie bookstores to stay in it. And as more of that business goes online, you're going to see more of those indie bookstores struggling to survive.
Think also with the Amazon drone project, you'll be able to get a book delivered to right on your doorstep via drone.
Hey, Rob, you know, tell you how fast they are, and you know, we get Prime here in Hawaii, thank God. 2 days, yeah. 2 days from the time I clicked buy now to this arrived at my doorstep, and it came. I was shocked, you know, just in a, and that's to Hawaii. So, you know, if they can deliver to Hawaii in 2 days, they can get it anywhere else. Yeah. So just so everybody knows, we'll make sure we get over to Scott's site at scottsigler.com and get over there and pre-order Pandemic right now and pick up his other books as well in his library. And definitely support his sponsor as well, because they support me as well. So definitely take care of that. And then check out his upcoming Pandemic trailer at scottsigler.com/pandemic. And this is, that wowed me this morning. That was the thing. It kind of was like, holy crap, that's really good. That's smart. And if you want more detail on Scott, you can find information on him on Wikipedia as well. I did read your Wikipedia entry this morning, Scott. That's how I figured out that you grew up in Michigan. So
cool. That
was a little intel that I got from Wikipedia. Sometimes they're right. luckily, they were this morning. But Rob, what do we have? I know that are we going to do anything next week, or are we off for a few weeks?
I think we're off. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we're off next week.
Okay. So here's my schedule, just so you know. I'm definitely out the 4th and 11th. I'll be in Vegas for CES the 4th and the 11th. So it could be as late as the 18th before we're back here, unless you want to do a solo show, and if you're more than welcome to do so if you want. Yeah, it'll be almost a month. That's a long time, podcast time.
That's a long time.
So, but, go ahead.
But that's what we need to do if, you know, if you're busy down in, CES.
Yeah. And I leave, the night of the 2nd and, don't get back until the afternoon of the 12th. So 10 days. That's, you know, it's hard enough to do Vegas for 3 days, but 10 days is just insane. So, but yeah, I won't be back, we'll be ready to go on the 18th. We've got, there's a lot of great back catalog in this show, folks, too. Last week's show got a lot of comments with, Doc Searles. We want you to go back and listen to that. The interview with the, Podcast One CEO was huge as well. That one continues to get, a lot of, views and listens. So there's a lot of stuff in the back channel, and I'll make sure today in today's show notes we've got the, you can find all the back channel right on the website at newmediashow.com. So we're going to be making some changes to the website too. It's going to happen soon. We're going to break down Geek News Central to a multi-user site, and New Media Show is going to get its own domain and a dedicated theme landing page. That's going to be coming early next year. So we're looking forward to doing that. We're going to do that for all the properties on the website. It's kind of my first publicly time talking about it, but we've got it sandboxed already. We're actually testing the new design, and we're going to have to do some magic with the servers and so forth to make sure we don't lose any Google juice and everything points where it used to point to. But otherwise, we're going to be making some major change, which I think will be good for the show. The show's grown up, hasn't it, Rob?
Yeah, it has. It's been great. It's been great. I think, 2014 is going to be a great year for the New Media Show, and podcasting and new media, I think, is still on the rocket ship up. So, we're going to cover it.
Yeah, yeah. Don Bain and I are going to have kind of a sister show to the New Media Show. We haven't officially announced what it is, but I think you guys will be excited when you hear what we're going to be talking about. And we've had actually some talks with some sponsors. They're actually saying we want to sponsor this all before we produce episode one, which is that's unusual. So we're looking forward to launching that. We'll have an announcement about that soon, exactly what that content's going to be like. But Scott, thanks. Anything else you want to pitch while you're on?
If you like hard science horror fiction, like The Walking Dead, anything of that stripe, you definitely want to go check out Infected. And hopefully you like that. Then read Contagious and snag Pandemic when it comes out on the 21st. Do go to scottsigler.com/pandemic. Watch that trailer. That's the future of book marketing right there. And it was done by a company called Aureus Grex in L.A. And Adrian Picardi is the guy who directed it. And I thought the actor did a great job. We are really, really happy with it. And if you've got young adult readers in your family, you definitely want to check out our Galactic Football League series. It's YA, kind of language safe, a lot of sports action, and you can learn more at galacticfootballleague.com or just go snag The Rookie on Amazon, and people really dig it. Teenagers and up really dig that book. If they're hardcore geeks and or sports fans, which is a very strange combination, either or, they tend to like that series, so check it out.
Very cool. Rob, anything final?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we look forward to hearing and seeing your books turned into a TV series. It'll be exciting. You know, definitely let us know when that's about to come out, and we'll ping it on the show, or you can come back on or something and talk about it.
And one more thing I forgot to mention, since everybody watching this is clearly podcast savvy, ScottSigler.com. There is an iTunes subscribe button, RSS subscribe button in the upper right-hand corner. We give away free, about 20, 30 minutes of free audiobook every week. And the one we're playing right now is called Nocturnal, which is in stores, but you can get it for free. And if you go to ScottSigler.com/nocturnal-episodes, there's links for the first 8 free episodes there. Tune into the story and join me every week.
That's great.
Scott, thank you so much. And of course, you can reach Rob or I here at the New Media Show. They could be Todd@newmediashow.com or Rob@newmediashow. Of course, my name is Todd Cochran. I want to thank my co-host, Rob Greenlee. Had the wrong lower third up there, didn't I, Rob? Let me try that again. But you can reach me at Geek News or reach Rob at Rob Greenlee as well on Twitter. So thanks, everybody. Yep. We'll see you next time. Take care. And here from Hawaii, aloha.
Bye.